For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
How do we know God is real? Well, in the book of Romans, we left off here where Paul's saying, I'm not ashamed of this good news about Christ. It is the power of God at work, rescuing everyone who believes, the Jew first and the Gentile, the good news. And he says this good news tells us how God makes us right in his sight. And this is accomplished from first to last by faith. As the scripture says, it's through faith that a righteous man, person has life. Okay, but faith, which means on one hand, trust, that we trust him, trusting God, but also believing the truth. And so how, you know, if I don't believe, if I'm skeptical, where am I to turn to know that I can safely believe this? Well, that's what comes up in this passage. He says, God's angry from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. So apparently some people don't want to hear the truth. They, for some reason, are aversive to the truth, and they push it away. They suppress it. They find ways to deny it. I wonder why they would do that. It seems like if something's true, you would want to know that. Not necessarily. Remember that. That concept's going to come up later. Verse 19 says, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. So this is saying when I look inside myself, I see something there that tells me that God exists. We're not going to study that tonight. We'll study that soon, a couple weeks from now. We're going to do this one. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, and his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so they're without excuse. This is saying when we look out at nature, what has been made, that which has been made, the creation, we can tell there must be a God, and we can tell that he must be a certain type of God, too. We can tell things about his nature. This is what's called the argument from design. The argument from design runs like this. First of all, the presence of design implies the presence of a designer. If we can define what design is, if we can ascertain that something has been designed, then that must imply, design doesn't just happen by definition. It has to be planned out. It has to be, to design something means that you have devised and organized it in a certain way. Secondly, our world manifests the presence of design. Okay, so most people would accept the first premise. The second premise, now here's where we need to look at what is the evidence. How do we know that our world is designed? Tonight we want to look at a couple of different areas that I think strongly suggest that it is designed at a very high level, an incredible level. The first is the origin of the universe itself. I don't know if you study, how many of us here study physics or follow the development of scientific learning in this area, but today Big Bang cosmology is considered normative. It's not based on, this is not a Christian thing. This is found in any science book. It is, in fact, a pretty much universal consensus today. There's virtually no objection raised to this proposition that the universe is expanding. This was first predicted based on Einstein's theory of relativity, but it was confirmed in 1929 when Edwin Hubble measured the red shift based on the Doppler effect. When objects are moving away from you, the spectrograph for various elements shifts to the left, to the longer wavelength, the red side of the spectrum. showing that it's retreating from you, like when a train comes by and goes by you, and the sound declines. In this case, because sound waves are longer waves as this moves away. And in this other case, it was light waves. But it's the same thing. And this has now been confirmed in every way, in so many multiple different ways. It's very clear. Now, if the universe is moving up away, all things are moving away from each other, then we can easily imagine reversing that trend. And what do we get? All things coming together. And based on measurements taken in recent decades, we can say with a high level of certainty that the entire universe was in one spot about 13.7 billion years ago. Again, Hawking, agnostic, but later in his last book declared himself an atheist. Almost everyone now believes the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. John Barrow, decorated British physicist and cosmologist, at this singularity, at this beginning point, space and time came into existence. Literally nothing existed before the singularity. There's nothing. And Paul Davies, author of a dozen different books on the subject of cosmology, a leading voice in this field, professor at the University of Arizona. In the past, the universe was smaller. If we run the expansion in reverse for 13.7 billion years, then the ball shrinks to a single point, a single sizeless dot. And then, nothing. The ball has vanished. So, the nothing before the Big Bang really is no thing. Neither matter nor space, just nothing. And so we have nothing, and then we have a universe. Okay, that's a very interesting transition to think about there. That worked out pretty well. What would make that happen? Why? We're saying that there's nothing exists, and then all of a sudden, boom, everything exists. No reason, no cause. Can you buy that? I cannot. I think this is, if we're saying there's really nothing, and then all of a sudden there's something massive, that raises some very important questions. The old atheistic polarity used to be God versus matter and energy. That's gone now. Now the polarity is God and nothing. One explanation for the universe is God, and the other explanation is nothing. I'd hate to defend that proposition.
Does God exist? Or is the material universe all that is, or ever was, or ever will be? One approach to answering this question is the cosmological argument. It goes like this. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore, the universe has a cause. Is the first premise true? Let's consider. Believing that something can pop into existence without a cause is more of a stretch than believing in magic. At least with magic, you've got a hat and a magician. And if something can come into being from nothing, then why don't we see this happening all the time? No, everyday experience and scientific evidence confirm our first premise. If something begins to exist, it must have a cause. But what about our second premise? Did the universe begin, or has it always existed? Atheists have typically said that the universe has been here forever. The universe is just there, and that's all. First, let's consider the second law of thermodynamics. It tells us the universe is slowly running out of usable energy, and that's the point. If the universe had been here forever, it would have run out of usable energy by now. The second law points us to a universe that has a definite beginning. This is further confirmed by a series of remarkable scientific discoveries. In 1915, Albert Einstein presented his general theory of relativity. This allowed us, for the first time, to talk meaningfully about the past history of the universe. Next, Alexander Friedman and George Lemaître, each working with Einstein's equations, predicted that the universe is expanding. Then in 1929, Edwin Hubble measured the red shift in light from distant galaxies. This empirical evidence confirmed not only that the universe is expanding, but that it sprang into being from a single point in the finite past. It was a monumental discovery, almost beyond comprehension. However, not everyone is fond of a finite universe, so it wasn't long before alternative models popped into existence. But one by one, these models failed to stand the test of time. More recently, three leading cosmologists, Arvind Bord, Alan Guth, and Alexander Vilenkin, prove that any universe which has on average been expanding throughout its history cannot be eternal in the past, but must have an absolute beginning. This even applies to the multiverse, if there is such a thing. This means that scientists can no longer hide behind a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. Any adequate model must have a beginning, just like the standard model. It's quite plausible then that both premises of the argument are true. This means that the conclusion is also true. The universe has a cause. And since the universe can't cause itself, its cause must be beyond the space-time universe. It must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, uncaused, and unimaginably powerful. Much like God. The cosmological argument shows that, in fact, it is quite reasonable to believe that God does exist.
Not bad. Yeah, good point. If we're looking at nothing as the cause of the universe, boy, do I have trouble with that. You know, when you think about it, something must have always existed. This idea of everything coming out of nothing for no reason is that's an unthinkable thought. Something has to have been here all along. Matter and energy? No, they're not eternal. That's what these findings are telling us. It's got to be something else. It's got to be something outside of time, extra dimensional, as she was saying. And we've got good reasons to believe that it's God. Not just the fact that the universe showed up, but also the way it showed up, the nature of the universe. Let's talk about that. The fine-tuning of the universe. Again, all of this is material that has come to light within the past century. And in this case, within the past few decades, has just burst on the scientific world. Okay, the way it works, Freeman Dyson, an agnostic cosmologist, explains, as we look into our universe and identify the many accidents of physics and astronomy that have worked together to our benefit, it almost seems as if the universe must have, in some sense, have known we were coming. That's what it looks like. He doesn't actually believe that, but he thinks that's what it looks like. Stephen Hawking, again, an absolutely not a believer. He says, the laws of science as we know them at present contain many fundamental numbers, like the size of the electron charge, the charge of the electron, the ratio and the mass of the proton and the electron. And he goes on to show how these are radically, finely tuned, that it cannot be more or less than exactly what it is. The remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. He says, for example, if the electric charge of the electron had been only slightly different, stars either could not have been able to burn hydrogen and helium, or they would have exploded, flown apart. If it's one more or one less digit than it is. It seems clear there are relatively few ranges of values for the numbers that would allow the development of any form of intelligent life. Paul Davies, again, he says it's virtually impossible that the universe came to have these correct parameters for life by chance, because so many of these numbers must all lie in such a small range of values. If the initial explosion of the Big Bang had differed in strength by as little as one part in 10 to the 60th, the universe would have either quickly collapsed back on itself or expanded too rapidly for stars to form. All you would have is a universe full of hydrogen molecules, hydrogen atoms. In either case, life would be impossible. Again, we're not saying that, and that I've seen a couple of presentations where they didn't seem to understand this, we're not saying that the entire universe is perfectly tuned to life. Neil deGrasse Tyson likes to point to the middle of a black hole. That's not very well tuned for life. And seems to be arguing that if it's not finely tuned everywhere, it's not finely. The argument here isn't that the life can live anywhere in the universe. It's that life to live anywhere at all, for any life to exist anywhere, you have to have these fine-tuned variables. How are you going to have life of any kind if there's nothing but hydrogen? Are you going to have a living hydrogen being of some sort? Or in a universe made up of nothing but black holes, we're going to get some kind of life out of that? Yeah, it's really pretty extreme. Dawkins, a virulent atheist, says physicists have concluded that if the laws of the constants of physics had been even slightly different, the universe would have developed in such a way that life would have been impossible. And so, let's imagine a line stretching from its two ends. And this line stands for the speed of the expansion of the Big Bang in the first milliseconds. How fast was it moving outward? At one end, 0 miles per hour, or next to it, barely moving at all. At the other end, the speed of light, as fast as anything ever goes. Somewhere in between there is the actual speed of the expansion of the Big Bang. Physicists studying this have concluded that that speed is extremely narrowly tuned to one part in 10 to the 55th power. If it was one notch faster or one notch slower, we wouldn't be talking here right now. We wouldn't exist. And it's the same thing where the universe would fly apart and never congeal the galaxies or stars, or where it would collapse back upon itself. What does that mean, one part in 10 to the 55th power? Okay, you know what a light year is, the distance traveled by a light in a vacuum over the course of a year. It's about 6 trillion miles. How many inches, though, are in a light year? Not miles, but inches. 3.7 some to times 10 to the 17th. Well, we're nowhere near there. I mean, we're 10 to the 17th. If we say, well, what about tenths of inches? That just changes it one order of magnitude to the 18th, 10 to the 18th. If we say, well, and a hundredth of an inch, now we're at 10 to the 19th. We're shooting for 10 to the 55th here. every additional factor is 10 times the size of the one before. This actually works out. Here we're talking about at a hundredth of an inch, we're talking about almost the width of a human hair, that big, in a line that stretches not one light year, but 10 to the 35th light years. We have a string that long, and we take a blindfolded person and throw a dart up over their shoulder, and it goes sailing out through space. The chances that it will hit the correct 100th of an inch line on that string is less than one chance in 10 to the 55th power. Good God. That's really unlikely. Man, that sure worked out well. But that's not all. See, we continue. This line stands for the strength of gravity. And that has also been determined to be radically fine-tuned down to one part out of 10 to the 40th power. So not as tightly as the speed of the expansion, but it's extremely, extremely unlikely. Here's the wild part, though. It's not one, it's not the other. It has to be both of them at the same time. And so if in probability, if you have one improbable thing and you add another improbable thing, how do you reckon those two together? It's 10 to the 40th times 10 to the 55th power. You just went into a number here that's totally unimaginable. And yet, it happened. We're here. Well, it goes on. The mass of the universe was critical at the time of the Big Bang, as little as, according to Davies, as little as a teaspoon difference in the amount of mass would have thrown off the expansion of the universe. It has to be exactly what it is, down to a fineness, tuneness of 1 times out of 10 to the 59th power. The ratio of electrons to protons is finely tuned, one part in 10 to the 37th power. That's the lowest one on here. It's going to be the most easy chance that this could happen. And so using that number, physicist Hugh Ross came up with this illustration to help people understand what that means. One chance in 10 to the 37th power. Suppose you cover the entire North American continent in dimes all the way up to the moon, a height of 239,000 miles. In comparison, the money to pay for the U.S. federal government debt would cover 1 square mile less than 2 feet deep. That might have gone up by now, might be four feet deep by now. This was a few years ago, but so a staggering number of dimes. Mathematically calculated by the size of a dime, it's not hard to do. Next, though, pile dimes to the moon on a billion other continents the same size as North America. A billion of these stacks. My God, is that a huge number. Then, get a cosmic hopper, you know, a big wire hopper, put all of these dimes in. That thing would have to be maybe the size of a galaxy or something. I don't know how big. And you've got all these dimes in there, so you can spin that thing and mix the dimes. And you take one dime and paint it red and throw it in there. Mix well. The chance, then you have a blindfolded friend come up and reach in and pull a dime out. The chance that he'll pick the red dime is one chance in 10 to the 37th power. Like I say, that just worked out awesome. Can't believe that succeeded. But we're not done here, okay? There are many other factors. The cosmological constant is the most extreme, finely tuned constant that we have. 1 in 10 to the 120th. That's 120 zeros. Listen to Leonard Susskind, again, an agnostic professor of physics at Stanford.
All right, let's talk about one of them, though, that has some particular strangeness to it, the so-called cosmological constant.
That's right. That's the one which is really on the knife edge. Okay, it is on such a narrow knife edge that it's almost inconceivable if you were to change it just the tiniest, tiniest bit, we couldn't be here. This constant, whatever made the universe, I hate to say whoever you made the universe, physicists have a habit of talking in that language, whoever made the universe. They don't really mean it. But whoever made the universe made it with an incredibly small, tiny cosmological constant. It is so small that it is 0.00000. We can sit here for a while. Yeah. 123 of them.
And then a one.
And then a one. I think it's actually a two.
Yeah.
But it is incredibly small, and nobody really knows why. So if it were just a little bit bigger, just a little bit bigger than this 0.00000, it would have prevented our existence. Physicists have never understood why it's so small. Nobody thinks that's accidental.
Yeah. He was still talking about the cosmological constant and that. It's funny that he couldn't resist using language about whoever created it and stuff. Yeah, I see why. And so a guy like this, and he later says, no one thinks that's an accident. Well, what is it then? I mean, if it's not an accident. These things pile up on top of each other, the decay rate of protons. I'm not going to go through all of them. There's over 30 of these lines, okay, that are agreed upon, both with, theistic and atheistic physicists all see this alike. But again, it's not just that these lines are finely tuned, but that they all are true at once. If we go back to our dime illustration, we had that big hopper full of dimes. And so just sticking with the smaller number of 1 out of 10 to the 37th power, for fine tuning to happen by chance, you would have to imagine 30 of these giant bins, not just one. And so you take all 30 bins and combine them into a super bin, okay? And now, once again, you color a dime red, but this time you're going to color 30 dimes red. 30 different dimes, all painted red, put in, mixed thoroughly, mixed deeply, and bring in our blindfolded person. He reaches in and pulls out a dime. It's red. Nice, but nowhere near what's required here. He's got to pull out another dime. We mix it around once, and he reaches and pulls a second dime. It's red, too. And he has to do that 30 times without any other dimes, only the red ones. Oh, my God. This is what we're talking about. And yet, there it is. It is this way. 30 times, all red dimes, no other dimes. I just don't think that's going to happen. I really don't. I find that impossible to believe. Well, okay, but these are smart people. You know, what's their answer? The non-theistic position. First of all, they don't argue with the numbers. And that's one thing. I'm not a physicist, but I go and read physicists. And they don't argue about the numbers. Oh, you're exaggerating. No. And you can rest assured with the level of enmity between those camps, they would be all over it if they thought that theistic physicists were exaggerating fine-tuning. No, that's not how they respond. The only response really that's come forward so far is the multiverse theory, or the ensemble of worlds. Under this theory, there may be other universes that we don't see, that we didn't know about, trillions of them. And so those are all different, but so sooner or later it was made sense that one of them would come out this way. And there's your answer right there. Multiverse. Let's think about this a little bit. The notion of alternate, parallel, non-life supporting universes is completely unverifiable by scientific observation. We can't measure it. We can't see it. We can't pick up any signals from it. And most physicists admit this. Brian Greene, a big proponent of the multiverse, says it will be extremely hard, if not impossible, for us to ever know the multiverse if the multiverse picture is true. Even if there are other universes, we can imagine that we'll never come into contact with any of them. So this is pure faith. No backing. whatsoever. And a second point made by Paul Davies, again, an agnostic, that the multiverse only moves the problem up from the universe to the multiverse. It really doesn't answer the question. If the multiverse did exist, they or the universe generating mechanism would require fine-tuning in their own right. Yeah, they argue that there's some mechanism that's turning out universes, one after the other, each one different. Where would that come from? Where did you get a machine like that? This is all pure imagination. Douglas L. explains in his book, L. is a graduated in physics from MIT, but he also has a law degree. His book, Counting to God, he points out that the anti-faith, he became a Christian because of fine-tuning, changed his mind, and felt like I just couldn't resist the logic. And so he says anti-faith adherents have to believe in three things. First, that there's some unknown branch of physics capable of producing universes with different laws and outstanding constants of physics. That's a big one to choke down there. Some branch of physics, we don't know what it is, but it must be out there. This unknown branch of physics has actually produced an infinite number of universes without beginning or end. And here he's alluding to the fact that most multiverse theorists today are moving to an infinite number of universes, because if it's a finite number, then you have the same problem that we just talked about, a universe coming out of nothing. And so the argument is it's been going on forever. Somehow, all of this just exists for no reason and without any cause. It's just the way it is. These three beliefs, which are not supported by scientific evidence of any kind, underlie the concept of the multiverse. Boy, is that a huge crock to choke down. Ask yourself this: when was the first time anyone heard the idea of a multiverse? They never talked about that when I was in school. You can find out by reading A Brief History of the Multiverse by Andre Lindy, who was one of the framers, one of the first people to publish in this field, and his date was 1982. Just a couple of years after the first papers on fine-tuning began to be presented to the scientific community. The whole reason for the multiverse theory is not because of something we've observed or because there is some, you know, unevenness in some field or anything of the sort. It's an answer to the fine-tuning of the universe. It's a way to get around the obvious implications. And I think, remember earlier we were reading about the idea that of people suppressing the truth. I think we got a case of that right here. I would rather believe in bazillions of invisible universes than to admit there's a creator. I think that's pitiful. Here's Davies goes it one better. This is the no-cause explanation. This is on his webpage. He says, physics predicts that time was indeed bounded in the past. It did not stretch back for all eternity. If the Big Bang was the beginning of time itself, then any question about what happened before the Big Bang or what caused it, in the usual sense of physical causation, is simply meaningless. One of his readers is asking, well, what happened before the Big Bang? What caused the Big Bang? He's like, He says, I didn't promise to provide answers to life, the universe, and everything, but I have at least given a plausible answer to the question I started out with. What happened before the Big Bang? The answer is nothing. Bold. Wow. And he goes on, he says, even if we don't have a precise idea of exactly what took place at the beginning, we can at least see that from the origin of the universe, from nothing, need not be unlawful or unnatural or unscientific. In short, it need not have been a supernatural event. And here he's lifted his skirt a little bit to show us the real reason. I would argue to the contrary that if you can have a result this massive as the universe itself with no cause, it overthrows the basic assumptions of all science. In science, we try to find causal relationships. That's a huge part of what it's all about. And here we're saying if a universe can explode out of nowhere for no reason, then anything can happen. Anything. There are no laws. And it puts blind faith in place of actual observation. What we can observe is the finely tuned universe. All this other crap, we cannot observe at all. We're just imagining that maybe that's the case. And you see his rationale. This way, it maybe doesn't have to be a supernatural event. This guy's name is Francis Collins. He's a Nobel Prize-winning scientist, the head of the Human Genome Project, really an elite, top-level scientist in the world today. One of very few with this level. He knows more about science than anyone in this room. He is an agnostic. And he changed his mind and became a theist, a believer, a Christian, in fact. And one of the things that got, the main thing that got to him was the fine-tuning of the universe. He says in his book, The Language of God, altogether there are 15 physical constants whose values current theory is unable to predict. They're givens. They simply have the values that they have. This list includes the speed of light, the strength of the weak and strong nuclear forces, various parameters associated with electromagnetism and the force of gravity. He says the chance that all of these constants would take on the values necessary to result in a stable universe capable of sustaining complex life forms is almost infinitesimal. And yet, those are exactly the parameters that we observe. In sum, our universe is wildly improbable. Yeah, well said. We just saw how utterly improbable it is, beyond imagination. And what do you call that? That is called design. Okay? That's a designed universe. Let's go back to Romans. Premise number two, our world manifests the presence of design. Oh, yeah. Oh, massive design, unimaginable design. What would it take to come up with something like this? And so we conclude that there is, in fact, a designer. A designer exists. And we can go further. It's not just any designer. The designer has to be sufficient to account for the design. Remember here where his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature. We can know more about this designer than in that he or it exists. We can know things that must be true. For example, intellect. What we're seeing is so vastly complex, so unimaginably complicated and perfectly fit together. That is an advanced mind that has thought something like that up. It's taken us thousands of years to get to the point where we finally even observed it. But to design it, to make that happen, oh man. And that intellect would have to be combined with will and intent. What we're looking at here is a real event in the Big Bang and the origin and the nature of our universe, which had to have been thought out ahead of time and then executed. So that's really forethought, right? It's intelligence, but it's also laying a plan and then carrying out that plan. All of these things that we're talking about have to do with something called personality, personhood, an impersonal version of God, like the Force in Star Wars. It's an it. It's not a he. In Eastern myth, in pantheism, God is all things, in all things, or he is all things, panentheism, a narrow difference. The point is, that version of God won't explain the design that we see in the universe. It doesn't explain anything. You need someone who can think and have intention. Intent, think about what that means. You know what it's like when I form an intention and I go after it? That's the activity of personal beings. And so not just any God or any designer is good enough here. We need a personal designer, incredibly powerful, and all the other things mentioned in that flick. The infinitude of God is probably also demonstrated here, that he's infinite, because otherwise you're back to what did God come from, right? And you have the same problem. Of course, the biblical answer is he didn't come from anything. He's always existed. He's the one thing. Okay, ask yourself, if something has been eternal, if something has existed forever, is it more likely that it would be matter and energy, or that it would be a spiritual being not subject to natural law? I think the second is way more likely. The first, we know, is not eternal. It's bounded in time. It only goes back 13.7 billion years. The creator has to be outside of that space-time continuum, and therefore, and has to be spiritual. A spiritual, eternal, personal God. That's what. The infinite personal God, a version of God, not very widely believed in other religions. You find it in Christianity, you find it in Judaism, you find it in Islam. All three of those come from the same source, the Bible. Think about that. They've gone different directions with it, but they all came from that original text. The same one we were studying last week that could tell the future. That one. Yeah, we got something here, all right. This is a pretty good argument. This blows me away. I feel very strengthened in my faith, because it's not an irrational faith, but it actually is very rational and fits the facts perfectly. We read about this notion of suppressing the truth, and that upsets God when people do that. He's given us the ability to sense. Even ancient people writing back at the time of Paul could look out and be like, something had to make this. This didn't just happen. They knew that. We still know it today. But people suppress the truth. God expects us to be honest. It's not asking too much to be honest with ourselves. You know, if you see something and you're like, oh my God, it might be true, and you do this, and you do this, you're being dishonest with yourself. You're refusing to look at something. There's no reason to do that. People try not to look at this. When I did it, I admit, I was totally into it. I can admit that now. When I was an atheist, it was because I didn't think that a God existing fit in with my plans. I wanted, you know, what came along with God is what bothered me a lot. I didn't want the accountability. And, you know, I would just say, okay, just don't even worry about that. If God is there, you're better off knowing it than not knowing it. And according to the Bible, in fact, this very book, later in the book, says that anyone who calls upon the name of the Lord will be rescued. You don't have to believe in advance. You can just come and talk to God and say, so is this really true? Are you there? Can you hear me now? Can you speak? Because, you know, I'm ready to hear that. And so you can combine this experience with rationality, and you come up with a reasonably based faith. God will answer you. You should think about that. Well, check this out. This design of the universe is not the only reason to believe. In fact, it may not even be the strongest argument. We've got more to look at. The hill is frankly upward from here, if that's possible. Much more to come. So I'm sure we'll see you next week. We got two more weeks to go on this. Are you going to be able to withstand it? You'll like it. All right. Yes, God, it's totally amazing that you are there, that you are so transcendent, you could create a universe, and that you also care about us. That's a real jarring picture there. And yet we saw clear evidence last week that you sent Jesus, that you came here in person. Wow. Yeah. Praise you, God. I pray for anyone here that's wondering about you tonight that they'll be honest enough to call out and say, show me the rest of the story. I'm ready. We pray for that in Jesus' name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.